It's not a limitation, but it's one of the big heavyweight questions going on right now because we're trying to standardize ethics, so to speak. But that means we still have to pay attention to all the different cultural aspects as well on top of it, which isn't as straightforward as people wish it were to be. But that cultural question, how do we both create something that is structured enough, a standard that is structured enough that we can understand what people are applying, what literal standard they're upholding, but adaptable enough that it doesn't clash with cultural values as well. Technology is merely a mirror of humanity back onto itself. And it's perhaps in one way very therapeutic for us to work through technological problems instead of emotionally laden human context and having to work through them in the technological context. And so I can see the benefit there of trying to work through it in that stance, but I think always it's necessary to keep in mind that, okay, we can play around with these ideas in our technology and we can adjust here and there, but it's we're looking back on humanity at the end of the day.
That was Olivia Gamblin, and this is episode 12 of the Bobby Jagdev podcast. Hey guys, welcome back to the podcast. Now, before we get into today's main event, I have a small request. If you could rate, review, and even subscribe to this podcast on whatever platform you use to listen to your podcasts, that helps me a great deal. And also, I have a mailing list. Yes, if you follow the link in the show notes and punch in your email address, you get notifications once new episodes are released, but also detailed show notes directly into your inbox. Now, today's main event. The human condition is this complex and unpredictable amalgamation of multiple intelligence characteristics. And, you know, our ability to make effective decisions requires us to make linguistic, emotional, and ethical judgments. But AI, artificial intelligence, doesn't yet cover all the things we as humans perceive to be intelligence. Now, the other facet to this is that computer-based data models, assumptions, algorithms, and even ethical frameworks that make up machine-based decision-making are all provided by humans, and they contain the same intentional and unintentional biases as their creators. Now, as we accelerate into this age of AI, we are naturally increasing our dependency on these decision-making machines. And, you know, some of the decisions that these machines make, and we're seeing this more and more, especially with the events of 2020, is they impact across the entire spectrum of societal functions, from science to education to health, much, much more. The list goes on. Now, social media, on the other hand, is indirectly influencing our personal decision-making process. It's shaping our political views, the people we like, we dislike, we trust, we distrust, and even the products that we buy and the services that we consume. But how suitable are our ethical models in protecting the rights of the people, protecting us, and also ensuring that humanity actually is pointing in the right direction, that we're not going off trajectory, off course, because of the intentional or unintentional motivations of a few people, few organizations, or governments. As we accelerate into this age of AI, and as it changes the shape and influences society, we also have to be cognizant of the fact that society in itself is made up of a multiverse of different cultures. And all of these cultures have their own distinct moral codes and ethical constructs. So the question that's floating around in my mind is, how do we apply ethical models to technology when, as technologists, we know that one size surely can't fit all? And I've always been fascinated by the construct of culture, from languages to traditions to ethics. And in the light of our digital acceleration right now, my curiosity for how we apply ethics to technology whilst still trying to maintain an appropriate cultural balance and without distorting cultures, that curiosity is naturally starting to accelerate. So I wanted to widen the aperture of my lens and qualify what I do or don't understand about this topic. So I enlisted the support of Olivia Gamblin. Olivia is an AI ethicist and the founder of Ethical Intelligence. When I first reached out to Olivia, what I didn't quite expect, though, was this shared passion for the construct of culture, especially when it's viewed through the lens of AI and ethics. This is another conversation where we get to travel through conversation. And in doing so, we start by unpacking Olivia's Italian-American heritage. We travel to Agriturismo, which is a tourist farm in Tuscany in Italy. Olivia's love for Italy, her memories of her grandfather, are truly wonderful to listen to. Now, Olivia's story around that Agriturismo isn't just the opener to our conversation, but it provides us a real insight into her persona. And it's a mindset which is centered around embracing the fear of the unknown, but at the same time, immersing herself with absolute focus in every single thing that she does. And often to do that, that requires bravery, especially in a field dominated by the male humanoid. A female mindset, one who speaks about culture with such honesty and adoration, I think is crucial in influencing the ethical models that I think we desperately need right now to minimize the disruption on society. And that demand is only going to get greater. Culture is the bedrock of this conversation. It creates a foundation that enables us to dive into the different types of ethical models. We explore terminology. What is the difference between ethics, philosophy, morality? And there are various touch points to recent events, such as the Netflix documentary, The Social Dilemma, and even the recent exam fiasco in the UK last summer. And those are just a few of the examples of some of the touch points that I think provide much needed context to a topic of conversation such as this. I felt really honored to have shared this conversational experience with Olivia because, you know, she talks openly about her heritage and the challenges of shaping the role of an AI ethicist. And that is a role that will be and is currently directly influencing the shape of our ethical landscape via the vehicles that we consume, the objects that we're influenced by, and the machine-based decisions that are and will be having a growing direct impact on the construct of our lives. So, with an aim to widen the aperture of our lens on this topic, I invite you to join my conversation with Olivia Gamblin. I was out for my morning walk and I kind of do a mental preparation for the recordings on my morning walk. You know, I got to have an idea of where I want to go with the conversation. And it was interesting because we had a fantastic conversation about, I think it's about 4 weeks ago when we first connected. And I was thinking, where is my in to this conversation with Olivia? And I realized there's just so many avenues that we can just start today's conversation. And it's funny, as soon as I went into my studio, I still wasn't sure where I'm going to start. So I am literally just going to go with one of them. And because there are just so many places that I can start. But one of the things that stood out for me, Olivia, when we first spoke, was a story that you started telling me that we never really finished, was about this time that when you were in Tuscany,
yes,
in a farm. And we got so far through that conversation and we didn't finish it. But I want to pick up from there and just understand how did you get to that farm? And I want to know more behind that story.
I think I'm still asking myself how I got to that farm, quite literally. I was living in Rome at the time and was just finishing up a digital art residency. So in a past life, as I like to say, I used to do a lot of digital art and design, literally in a past life. But I was finishing up a residency, and I had some space between that residency and my next project. So I was asking around of, hey, anyone have any open projects or just interesting opportunities that may be open to fill that space? Friend of a friend was working for, it's called an agriturismo, so it's like a tourist farm, so to speak, like literal translation from Italian. And it's basically these farms that are open to the general public. It's kind of like a bed and breakfast with the added element of you can also do farm work for fun in it as well.
I like that, for fun.
Yeah, exactly, for fun. It's absolutely beautiful out there. Mm. And so I ended up being able to arrange this deal where I went and literally lived on this farm for roughly about a month. And I was exchanging translating and design for room and board, as well as copious amounts of pasta. And I remember the reason why I was saying I can't quite literally remember how I got to that farm was I was told about a day or two. I was told the day that I was headed to the farm, and it was a Tuesday. On Sunday evening, I get a message saying, okay, get on this train at 9 a.m. out of Rome and take the train to, I think it was Ponte Vecchia or something like that, and take the train there, get off the train, and look for a man named Marco. It's like, do I get a description of Marco? Who is this Marco? Should I hold up signs? What am I looking for? So it was kind of a blind leap of faith, packed up my bag, got on the train, got off in middle of nowhere. I'm standing there looking around. I'm like, I don't recognize anyone. I have no idea where I am. And all of a sudden there's this big Italian kind of coming up to me looking very serious. And he goes, Olivia. I say, yes, that's me. And he goes, okay. And then just kind of beckons me to follow at this point. It's like, okay, here we go. I'm going to follow you. Get into his car, which is, he was one of the cooks on the farm. So his car was literally full of piles and piles of flour everywhere. It's like, this is strange, but okay, let's go. The farm was probably about 45-minute drive. And so we're driving, and he spoke a very thick Tuscan accent. And now I speak traditional Italian. And the Tuscan accent is fairly easy to learn, but unless you know what you're listening for, it can be very hard to understand the first couple times you hear it. All of the CHs are turned into just Hs. So instead of this hard K sound, you're getting H. And there's a few words switched. And so we're trying to communicate in this car, both of us, I think, equally confused about who the other person was on the way to a farm in the middle of nowhere. So that's why I quite literally did not know how I got physically to that farm, but I made it.
It was a bit of a blur, that journey was then.
Yeah. I think about half.
And you weren't covered in flour at the end of it.
I was. I think the next month, I was just covered in flour and mud, just depended on where I was for the day.
So on the farm, what kind of work were you doing on the farm?
It was really quite an amazing arrangement. So I would work mornings. They had a small office, and I'd work the mornings with them. My main job was they were trying to translate their entire website into English. So I was working with them to help improve some of actually the marketing and the phrasing, but also translate it into English. Then beyond that, I was working on a couple of just design packages. So they had different activities that you could do, and I had a lot of fun with it because it was basically just using the natural scenery. I would go out in the afternoons taking pictures of the surroundings, and then I could use that in my design for these packages. And then the afternoon, it was actually quite fun. So the morning was spent really working with them a bit in the office, a bit on the farm, just depended on where they needed me. And then lunchtime, everyone would come in from the field. And so this was off season, so there weren't as many people on the farm as normal. But of course, it's all of these burly Italian men that have been heavy lifting in the fields all day. And we all come in, and one of the cooks would make literally just this giant pot of pasta. And he'd sit us all down, and we'd be eating this pasta. And for the first week or so, I had to keep reminding him, sono piccola, I'm small. I can't eat as much as everyone else. You can't, like, it's just, it's not working. And then the afternoon was more, I would hang around the kitchen, I'd help there, or I'd be free to literally just wander the literal hills of Tuscany.
Wow.
So it was, I think it's one of those points in life that I look back on, wow, I have no idea what good karma came my way to end me up there.
You know, the experience just sounds amazing though. And in regards to, you know, you speaking Italian, am I correct in assuming that, you know, you were fairly proficient anyway in your Italian?
By that point, yeah. It's something that I learned later in life and I'm still perfecting it. Mm-hmm. One of the difficulties is that dialects are very strong in Italy. So even though I speak traditional Italian, when I go into the different regions, especially in the countryside, I can be completely lost and no one can understand each other still.
And, you know, one of the things that I find relatable is my family's originally from Punjab in northern India. And, you know, so I grew up speaking Punjabi because my mom predominantly spoke Punjabi. But again, I can kind of relate to all the different dialects and, you know, kind of changes in language, because, you know, one of the things that I always picked up on was people weren't necessarily always very supportive in kind of helping you nurture the, you know, picking up the language. Because sometimes, so with Punjabi, it's very much like French, where there are masculine and feminine words. And I'd always interchange them. So you'd end up just offending people because, yeah. and when those things happen, nobody's really supportive in helping you to correct you. It's kind of like you know, just made a fool of yourself.
Yeah.
And that kind of then knocks your confidence. Was there any of that when you were there, especially when you were kind of bouncing between different dialects and regions?
A bit. I was very lucky before that to actually make a very good friend while I was living in Rome. He and I are still close friends to this day, and we did a tandem together. And that was very entertaining because we would go out for the typical aperitivo, the drinks, and I would be speaking Italian with, I don't have a very strong American accent, but you can tell that I am not a native speaker of Italian. You can, for the most part, people usually guess that I'm native English speaker. But I, of course, I'm speaking Italian with this accent. And then I have Matteo across the table from me speaking English with a very thick Italian accent. And people would just give us these looks of like, clearly you two speak the same language, but why flip the language? And why with the accents? And so that was actually a great time to be able to kind of get around those problems. But it was absolutely, coming from English into Italian, having to learn the feminine, masculine versions and completely offending people, or God forbid, the little old ladies, if you didn't use the proper tense with them, they would give you this look of like, you've offended them for generations.
Yes.
Like, I'm so sorry, I forgot the proper tense. That one's hard for me to remember because you don't use it that often. So I can definitely empathize with you there when it takes a certain amount of vulnerability to learn a second language.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, because it's you can't express yourself as strongly as you can in your native language. So it's almost like you're automatically at a bit of a disadvantage. But at the same time, I think it's something very beautiful. Ever since learning that Italian, I'm now going on to learn new languages because I feel, and I don't know about you, but I feel like I have almost a different personality I discover with each language that I learn.
You do, you know, and my children have picked this up with me and my wife. So her family are also from a Punjabi background. And, you know, similar to what you said, we will flip between both languages just in conversation.
Yeah.
And it's, and part of that, I don't know, it's just a natural thing that we do. And over time, we've been able to improve each other's Punjabi by doing that as well. And, but you're entirely right. We do end up with this different personality when we're speaking another language, because I think there's elements of immersing yourself in some of those cultural attributes that then come out of what you're vocalizing.
Yeah. Would you say in what's your personality in English versus Punjabi?
So that's a good question. So I think one of the things about the Punjabi language is that Punjab is very much an agricultural, it's an agricultural area in India. So there is more of, it's not the most eloquent language in the world. So it's a little bit more crude with some of the things that are said, and a little bit more abrupt as well. I think in English, I'm hoping that I'm a little bit more structured with how I speak. I'm a little bit more softer with my tone, and I'm a little bit more all-encompassing. There's a wider spectrum to conversation and the way I'm receptive and the way I kind of, you know, converse with people. But as I said, with Punjabi being from an agricultural background, there's just very directness.
Yeah.
So when I speak Punjabi, it is very just direct. There is, you know, it's black and white. There is no gray. And part of that also, I think, comes back to the fact that I'm not massively proficient. So when you kind of know enough to be able to converse, you don't necessarily have that spectrum in the vocabulary to kind of construct, maybe a more intelligent conversation. So I'm very much just very black and white when I speak Punjabi.
I like that. You're like, this is how it is, done.
That's it. And also, it has this clandestine purpose as well, because my children are now understanding it. They don't have the confidence to speak it. But when they were younger, me and my wife used to use it as a tool to be able to speak about them when they've done something that they shouldn't have done. But now they know.
Like, damn.
Exactly. So that doesn't work now. But I know. I think, as you're saying, there are different personality attributes. And, you know, you mentioned something earlier that you picked up Italian kind of later on. I remember you saying that your great-grandparents migrated to the US. But were you traditionally from an Italian-American family? Was that your upbringing? Or is that something that you've kind of adopted as you've come closer to it, as you got older?
Both. I absolutely grew up in a very Italian-American setting. There are pictures of me, I think age of three, drinking, I think it was either a decaf or probably a hot chocolate, to be fair, cappuccino with my grandfather in the morning. It's like little three-year-old me, because I wanted to be cool, like no. He taught me how to make pasta. My dad taught me how to make pizza. We have like family recipes that we get passed down. We have traditions, for example. For Christmas, we always handmake ravioli together.
That's lovely.
And it's an all-day event, and it's all surrounded by that. And then we always have something called pan dolce, which is specifically from one of our regions, from our ancestors are from Liguria. And that's an all-day event, and it always happens. And so we kept a lot of those traditions, also in the aspect that family is family, and you show up for family, and you show up for holidays. We're also just very loud. every family dinner, I remember growing up, and kind of one of those best underlying tones of my childhood was we always had family dinner, and we sat around the table. And sometimes we were all mad at each other and yelling, and sometimes we were laughing and sharing stories about the day, but we always sat down to family dinner.
Yeah.
And I think that really shaped a lot of my understanding. So I have the family background, and then as I've gone through this process, almost tracing back the steps of my ancestors in a way, I've come closer and closer to the Italian culture. It's something that I've always loved. And then now being able to speak the language and being able to live there on multiple occasions and having very good friends there that almost call me back constantly, it's taken on a new form, a new element in my life that's grown over the past few years.
But do you think that, and just talking from my own experiences, I think growing up when I was younger, there was part of my heritage that I wasn't entirely comfortable with, because I was a minority always a minority somewhere. And it took a while for me to then become more comfortable in my own skin and actually accept that my heritage actually is something pretty incredible. And just being able to just have this conversation with you, Olivia, is not a conversation that I would have been comfortable having like 10 years ago. But for you, do you think there was any element of that may have changed you been more encompassing of your Italian heritage?
Absolutely. I think, ironically, it was actually almost in the reverse. So when I first was able to live in Italy for the first time and get closer and closer to that culture, part of the background behind all of this, I was able to declare Italian citizenship actually in my teenage years. When my grandfather passed away, we went through the whole process and were able to actually have this, have the citizenship. And I think it's one of the most valuable things it sounds weird to say I own, but it's opened up so many doors in my life. But that first time that I was able to live in Italy and not just go and visit the cousins or go for holidays, when I was actually able to live there, I almost had this weird reverse where I was embarrassed by the American culture. Not for the reasons being, I look very Italian on the streets. I have the Italian passport, and yet I would still stumble when speaking, or I didn't fully know all of the cultural cues, or, you know, when you grow up in a country or anywhere, you pick up like the TV that they watch or just kind of the traditions. And so I didn't really know those. I knew pieces from growing up with my family, but I didn't know it like someone that grew up in Italy. And so I had this weird reversal where I was almost going into Italy feeling like an imposter of, should I really actually have this citizenship? Do I have any right to be saying that, yes, I'm half Italian? Do I have that right? And so through that process, understanding, okay, being in a new country and trying to assimilate into the culture, that process really made me much more understanding for other people that kind of make that same transition, or people that come from different cultures. And then I think, again, another big one, which was an eye-opener, actually wasn't with Italy, but when I moved to Brussels, I did not speak French. I take that back. I pretended to learn 3 years of French in high school, and I knew how to say hello. And that was it. And I think the first few weeks I was there, I would just tell people, je ne parle pas, I don't speak. I was trying to say, I don't speak French, but I was just telling people, I don't speak. Very confused looks. But that process, actually living in another country where I really didn't speak the language, I was trying to learn it, but seeing people either with patience or without patience for me really opened my eyes, because when you grow up in America, you're much less patient with someone that English is their second language. You're like, oh, you should learn English.
Yeah, just get to the punchline. I don't just want to know what it is that you're trying to say.
Yeah.
It's kind of...
Yeah. Now I feel like that's really opened my eyes, that whole process of how difficult it is, not necessarily to learn the grammar and the vocabulary, but how difficult that is to put yourself out there going, I know I'm going to sound stupid. I can be the most brilliant person in my native language, but I'm going to sound stupid when I start speaking a new language.
Well, it's kind of getting past that vulnerability. And also, I think did you feel as though you had to earn that citizenship?
Absolutely. I think I've slowly started to earn it. I think the first time I felt like, okay, I at least can pass for not just another American who declared citizenship through their ancestors and just uses it. I think it was one of my Italian friends. We were out for drinks and we were in a group back when, you know, you could meet in groups of people. And someone made a comment about Americans or something like that. And immediately my friend is like, oh, yeah. Wait, hold on. Ali, you're American, right? It's like, yes. And he goes, I keep forgetting that. I'm like, okay, I feel like I can blend in. I feel like I've earned, not that I've neglected my American heritage at all. I still see how that actually, I feel that the American culture impacts a lot of my work ethic, my work, my approach in my professional life. But the fact that I could blend in, so to speak, in my personal life and not be that, as everyone knows, the glaring loud Americans coming into a group, that felt like the first kind of rite of passage of, yes, okay, my accent blends in enough. I think I don't come across as a loud American. This is good. Step forward.
Well, and also it's the fact when you immerse yourself in those cultures, it's the fact that, you know, I've always been a strong advocate that we need multiple versions of ourselves mm-hmm. to do the things that we do. So, you know, for a while, I was kind of like, you know, I want to be the best version of myself. And then I realized that that doesn't necessarily stand true. I want to be the best version of those multiple versions of myself. Mm-hmm. And just kind of playing that into what you're saying is that when you're immersing yourself into those cultures, you're just trying to create that version of yourself that is applicable mm-hmm. to those environments. I think that is perfectly acceptable. That doesn't make people unauthentic. I think it's the fact that it adds another string to your bow. And that immersion, I think, is important, because if you don't necessarily immerse yourself in that thing you're trying to do, or that environment, or the language, or the people, or the food, everything, you're not necessarily going to get the true value mm-hmm. from those experiences.
Exactly. You almost, yeah, you need to dive in, just straight in. And that's when you start to find the value and kind of the meaning behind all of it. And I can completely agree with you. It's quite interesting having, I think if you meet me in a professional setting versus meeting me, I don't know, out for drinks in a personal setting, I can seem like a very different person. Mm-hmm. And I used to have people comment every so often that I came off as inauthentic, but when they knew me in a personal setting and they saw me in a professional setting, they're like, "Who is this? You're not being authentic." And then vice versa of, "Who is this?" But I think as the years have gone, I've discovered that all of those facets of myself, yes, are completely authentic and different. It's like I'm highlighting different aspects of myself, and that turns into how I portray myself in different settings. But they're all connected at the center of that. They're parts of who I am. And the people, I think this is also how I've started to know who are really the people I'm very, very close with in life. They're the ones that know all of those different personalities or aspects or personas that I have. And they're like, yeah, that's just Olivia.
There's an Olivia for a moment, for a situation.
Exactly.
And that's all good, you know. And I think you're the more people I think are aware of being comfortable in various skins. Mm-hmm. And I think it's kind of unashamedly just throwing yourself in those situations and just being completely vulnerable, which is a scary thing to do.
Absolutely.
But I think once you do it, the value and the rewards off the back of that can be incredible.
I think it's probably one of the scariest things I have done or I've learned to do is to throw myself fully into these and not be afraid of the different characteristics that are highlighted in different situations, and just understand that no, it's not me hiding, it's me using my characteristics, my personality to the fullest extent that moment calls for. And that means it takes different form. But it is absolutely terrifying to do it in the beginning. And it's still terrifying. I think maybe I just got used to doing it. And every so often I'll have a moment where I stop and go, "What am I doing here?" And then that's when the kind of vulnerability, that fear with the vulnerability comes back, kind of slams into my face.
I think there's a degree of kind of, you know, confusion, I think, can kind of come through with those situations and kind of transcending between personalities and environments. And the, you know, one of the things that I kind of always found confusing, I think, as I was growing up and kind of having, you know, having a heritage somewhere and being somewhere else. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the fact that, you know, it's kind of overused. I think when people say, you know, it's kind of the best of both worlds, you do take the best things from those worlds. And it's largely true. But there's also a degree of confusionism that kind of arises from that, where, you know, you have two cultural environments that you're in. But, you know, for yourself, what, if any, distinctions would you see between the kind of culture around morals and ethics between, you know, your Italian American heritage and your regular American heritage?
Oh, okay. I think one of the biggest ones I can see is the focus. And I'll go into that in depth. So with American culture, it's a very individualistic society. always has been. That's just the culture in the States. And so it's the focus there is the individual. What is best for the individual? It's very, you can tell privacy is a big deal there because that's an individual value where I am protecting, I am private of my own information. Whereas Italian, it's much more, the focus is on the family or on the community. Mm-hmm. And so you'll see the focus there being more on helping each other, meaning like instead of every man for himself, so to speak, it's more more every community for itself, but you have the communities.
It's the collective.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Exactly. And that, that seeps into a lot of different ways that you see different moral principles take effect and how they're put into action from the American versus the Italian perspective. And it is interesting. Sometimes they clash. Sometimes I feel like I get caught in the middle of it all. But I don't know. I like having the two perspectives at the end of the day.
Absolutely. And I think, especially for the line of work you're in, I think those two perspectives are actually quite important and quite influential. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, I've always kind of thought or felt as though, you know, culture is an output of different morals and different ethics. Mm-hmm. We often say that, you know, ethics is either, it's just right or is it wrong? And but in reality, what can be right and wrong in different areas of the world and different cultures can also vary. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the things that I'm keen on actually understanding, because I get rather confused around this topic, is around the terms around philosophy, ethics, mm-hmm. and morality. And I think ethics and morality is often interchanged. I do it myself all the time, largely because of not necessarily understanding the distinction between them. But I'm really keen on actually understanding that with the lens that you would apply around philosophy, ethics, and morality. What actually is the difference between those three terms?
Yeah. So I'm going to keep it very simple. So philosophy, of course, is kind of this field of study. So philosophy of morality and ethics, it's literally just the philosophy, understanding the terms, understanding the methodologies, the reasoning patterns, the processes within ethics and morality. So philosophy is kind of the field, so to speak. Mm-hmm. Morality specifically is focused on the principles. So you're looking at kind of moral codes. You're looking at what do we uphold as good? So when you're looking at it, we would say, is honesty good? And that's more a question of morals. Is honesty mm-hmm. a moral principle that we want to uphold? It also asks questions. There are concepts such as moral attention, moral understanding. Those are asking questions about your ability to understand situations, understand if they are morally laden situations, if they require decisions that have to be reasoned through morals, so to speak. Mm-hmm. Ethics is much more practical. So mm-hmm. with ethics, you are determining, at least in normative ethics, you're determining, is this action right? Is this action wrong? So you're looking then, they play off of each other. You're looking at moral principles, and based off of those moral principles, you're deciding if a certain situation is good, or is it ethical, meaning it follows that moral principle. So they are, and you can use them colloquially, interchangeably. They're not, I mean, if I say morals or ethics, you know generally that I'm talking about good versus bad and all of the complexities that lay in there. So it's even as a philosopher that studies moral philosophy and ethics, I still interchange them every so often as well. And I'm like, oh, right, shoot, it's the other one. They're just, they're used so easily and it's nuanced.
So if I kind of replay back what I think I understood is that the philosophy feels like ivory tower thinking. So you're kind of up looking from 10,000 feet in the air. And then the ethics is kind of on that ground where mm-hmm. the ethics get applied to real life situations. And I guess, is it fair to say then the kind of morality is the kind of buffer in between?
Yeah. That's a pretty good way to phrase it. Because morality is much more on the abstract level. Mm. You're looking at the abstract of it all. You're trying to deduce kind of these universal rules and laws. And there is a field called metaethics, which gets into the debate of free will and determinism and where do moral principles come in the first place. And that's very abstract and very, it is quite a field to try and unpack. But the kind of ethics that we see in day-to-day life, the kind that we talk about in conversations, is the much more practical. Yeah, I like that layering, yeah, that you've described.
Well, and if we scale that layering out wider, and we try and apply different cultures and different regions of the world to this conversation, does it, and I might be pushing this too far, does morality kind of span over multiple cultures, where then when you look at the ethics, they're then individual branches, because different things ethically are acceptable in other places where they may not be somewhere else. But when you kind of go back to the morality, mm-hmm, and then the overlying philosophy, the branching off then occurs at the layer of ethics. Does that make sense, or have I got carried away with the analogy?
yeah, it's actually a great example. I can give it actually in a very concrete picturing. So there are a lot of different ethical guidelines going out right now by different government bodies in context of AI and technology. If you read these guidelines, 9 times out of 10, you're going to have transparency on them. For some reason, transparency is the one that I always refer to, but there are others that each one refers to, but transparency. That means you're seeing transparency on the guideline for the EU. You're seeing, there's not really guidelines out of the US yet, but it surfaces in some of their documents there. You're also seeing it out of the guidelines from Beijing, which normally a lot of people would think that the guidelines that come out of Beijing should be very different than the ones coming out of the EU. Well, actually, those are just very, not universal, so to speak, but transparency is one that we've all kind of accepted. That one would be kind of a moral principle. But it's how it's applied, how it actually comes into practice, that you see the big difference. And that's, again, where the cultural application comes in. That's where you are deciding ethically, does this uphold transparency? Does it not? In the European context, it's going to be very different than the Chinese context. That's just the cultural differences happening there.
And I guess that framework then is important for you to have the right structure behind the work that you're doing. And, you know, and the reason I wanted to open this conversation about kind of diving into us both exploring our own different cultural backgrounds, I think is the direct relevance to the fact that, you know, as the demand for AI ethicists starts to scale out and increase, which it's naturally going to, because we're moving into this period of a wider social responsibility in regards to the machines and our data. And I think the cultural attribute is of huge importance, because what you can apply in one country doesn't necessarily translate straight to somewhere else.
No, that's one of the very, I don't want to call it a limitation. It's not a limitation, but it's one of the big heavyweight questions going on right now, because we're trying to standardize ethics, so to speak. But that means we still have to pay attention to all the different cultural aspects as well on top of it, which isn't as straightforward as people wish it were to be. But that cultural question, how do we both create something that is structured enough, a standard that is structured enough that we can understand what people are applying, what literal standard they're upholding, but adaptable enough that it doesn't clash with cultural values as well. Because the cultural values, that's not something that we want to overrun. It's good to have cultural values. Yes, we're maturing as cultures, and you can always make arguments for, well, this part of the culture is not good versus this part of the culture is good, or this culture is better than this culture. All of that aside, we each have our own cultures, and we live through those cultures, and we have values through those cultures. And that's good. that's not a bad thing, that there's a bit of chaos there.
The other thing that kind of comes to mind from that is the kind of influence then on cultures by technology. So it's not just assessing the kind of ethical standpoint of whatever this thing is doing, but it's how much is the technology then starting to have a knock-on impact for good and for bad, to the ethical standpoint of different cultures. Because with every culture, there are things that, okay, we may not be aligned to because it's not what we believe. But then at the same time, there are things that are actually better. But how far does the conversation then go into understanding, can technology, social media then have a negative influence on potentially starting to distort other cultural values? Where in one country it's okay to do something, in another we might not think it is, but it's okay for them.
I have two thoughts going off of this. One has to do with a comedian, which may sound a bit out in left field, but it's actually, I think, captures this really well. Was watching a clip, I think it was Jim Jefferies, just a comedian, and one of his bits, he was talking about how, you know, 10 years ago, a comedian's job anyway is to toe that line, to walk that line of, is this, like, I'm just towing that line of this is inappropriate, but I can push the boundaries right there. And he was saying how he was commenting, he did it in a bit, so he was making it entertaining and funny, but he was commenting about how people were finding old videos of his old stand-up comedy and how they were getting upset about, like, how could you say that? And all these things. And he's like, when I did that bit, the line was here. You've moved the line since then, but of course I can't go back and redo that. So the best I can do is take down those old videos, but it's like the line got moved. And I think that shows as well, technology enables us to compare cultural values quite easily now because we have access to all of this information. And there is that risk of saying, okay, this is not appropriate, but in that culture, the line's somewhere else. And that can be hard to recognize, especially when you're coming from your own culture and you don't realize that this is just a cultural norm there. And yes, I'm not saying that all cultural norms are good. There are ones that we need to improve on, which leads me into my second point. But it's just saying that there is that kind of acceptance that we need. But the second point I want to make, and this one's coming from the ethicist in me. one of my fears surrounding technology and ethics are kind of race, it feels like, to standardize ethics and set into code these principles. And this is it. And this is how you act in this situation. My fear is actually that we're going to stunt ourselves. So there's something called moral maturity. And what it means is as you grow and as you go through different situations and you make decisions, your moral understanding, your ability to comprehend your situations and the best moral decisions to make grows with you. Now you have to go through different situations. And we can see this, like your understanding of good versus bad develops over time. We hope that it always develops in the positive direction way. In a forward progression. My fear is if we start setting down principles now and not budging, not allowing ourselves the room to adapt them and grow them, and instead then relying on our systems and our machines to tell us what is right and wrong, we will stunt ourselves. We don't give ourselves any space then to say, that was not the right decision. This is the right decision. Okay, I'm growing. Now I know the next situation that I do this in, I will do a better decision. So that's actually my real fear there about the potential effects technology can have on our understanding of ethics and morals.
And also it's the fact that reliance on technology also stunts our ability then to be creative and to innovate, because you know, humankind has survived and evolved off the basic need to think for themselves. And you know, once you start to take, I think when you start to take that away, and then you also apply what you stated around the ethical dilemma of kind of setting these in stone, I think you end up stunting multiple facets of what makes us human.
Mm-hmm.
And then inevitably that could then have quite a negative impact then on our own evolution,
yeah.
on our next stage of human development.
I often give the example in this case, 100 years ago, women weren't allowed to vote.
Mm.
We've learned since then that that's not cool. And we've matured as a society to understanding that, okay, it is good for women to vote. Done. Yeah. Every person, of course, every person, it is good that every person has the right to vote. Now, and I'm not saying machines should have the right to vote. I should just preference that. I would actually argue opposite, that that should never be the case. But say we mature as a society and 100 years from now, we're like, I can't believe 100 years ago, the robots didn't vote. Who thought that? Like, I'm not saying that that's how it should go, but it's a very blatant example of society matures over time.
Absolutely.
As well in our understanding.
Yeah.
And right now, where our society is at now, there are ways that we can improve.
Mm.
There are always going to be ways for us to improve. If we stunt ourselves now, we're going to be stuck at this point in time. And clearly, if anything, 2020 has shown us that we need to grow.
When you apply that viewpoint of, you know, like you say, you know, going back 100 years in time, where if you look at the collective of people in power at that time, their ethical judgment was the fact that it's not okay for women to vote.
Yeah.
Because, you know, for whatever various reasons, they thought that was the case. But, and you're right, if you apply the ethical standpoint of what felt correct to them, mm-hmm. as leaders, then, you know, we'd be in a complete dire situation right now.
Yeah.
And you can apply that to so many scenarios over human history, because I think, you know, societies, cultures, political movements have had a time, they've had to evolve. Some of them have done good things, some of them done very bad things. But if those events didn't occur, people just don't make those mistakes to then be able to evolve and to get to the next stage.
Yeah. Exactly.
And if the framework is just too rigid now, how far does that go? And actually, the other area of complexity to potentially add to that is, you know, when we talk about the machines and we talk about artificial intelligence, we always just kind of bucket intelligence into this one thing.
Mm-hmm.
But the human characteristics of intelligence are they're far wider, because, you know, we have linguistic intelligence. What we've actually spoken about at the beginning of the conversation, you know, logical intelligence, mathematical, experimental, these are all traits mm-hmm. of human beings that make us intelligent. But when we talk about the machine, nobody ever really goes into some of the details around those different traits and characteristics.
Mm-hmm.
But when you apply ethics, or actually, let me ask the question differently. Is there any logic in applying ethics any differently to different types of human characteristics?
To different types of human characteristics, what do you mean by that?
So when we apply, let's use an example.
Mm-hmm.
So let's use personality assessments as a potential example, because that is something that is happening more often than it ever used to before. I kind of have a negative view on kind of, you know, computer-based personality assessments.
Mm-hmm.
You know, to me, and this is just my own biased opinion here, it feels as though these are people trying to cover their back in regards to who they recruit and you know, and the reasons why they recruit them.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm happy to be proven wrong. As in, you know, oh, I didn't hire this person because computer said no. And, you know, if computer said yes and the person didn't end up being a good fit, then it's the computer's fault and not mine, because I outsourced the accountability
mm-hmm.
to the machine to make the decision. And I think it's, you know, applying the different forms of human consciousness to that is that, you know, we will make a logical assessment. If we were to interview that person, we'd make a logical assessment. And then we may even make a linguistic assessment based on how well they communicated.
Mm-hmm.
And we also have a tendency to make a biased assessment as part of a conversation as well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there could be various characteristics of that person. They were dressed really well, and I liked how they were dressed, and that's going to influence my decision on recruiting them. But when you look at that example, there is a degree of kind of questionability as well when we look at some of the biases that we apply to our own intelligence. Does that apply any differently when we look at it from an artificial standpoint? Did that help actually qualify the question, or did I make it worse?
Yeah, I think I've got it. I think I get what you're trying to hit at. Let me give it a shot. No, I like where
you're
trying to go.
If I haven't, and you just want to be polite, that's okay. Just tell me that it still doesn't make any sense.
No. I like what you're trying to hit at, or the direction I'm trying to see as well.
I just might not be articulating it in the best way, I think.
It's difficult. When you get into these intelligences, it's like, okay, picking here, picking there. And you're like, this is so clear in my head. Why can't I explain it? I run into that problem all the time, considering our name is Ethical Intelligence, and I try and explain there's so many different intelligences. One of them is ethics. I think with that, so the term artificial intelligence, it was picked as intelligence way back in the day because it seemed to be the closest thing to how people could conceptualize what the creators were, not the creators, that sounds very godlike, but what the original founders, we'll call them, of artificial intelligence were doing. The thing though there is that term artificial intelligence, there's current work being done about the de-anthropomorphization, very long word, but de-anthropomorphization of AI, where it separates AI from these terms that are very human. Intelligence is one of those, because what the term artificial intelligence does is it communicates that, okay, it's an intelligent machine. Really what it is, that intelligence is very limited, like you were saying. It's usually logical or mathematical intelligence. It does not encompass emotional intelligence or ethical intelligence or sometimes spatial intelligence, depends if you're working with robotics or other systems, but it doesn't encompass everything that we know to be intelligence. And so just even with the name of artificial intelligence, it's limiting, and it is kind of a misnomer. It really can be confusing then towards society, where it's like, okay, of course it's intelligent. It reasons like a person. No, it embraces one of many intelligences that we use on a day-to-day basis to make our decisions. I'm part of a project called Deep Decision Making. And one of the things that project, it's a research project going on. One of the things that I really enjoyed about that is kind of breaking into, there are so many factors that go into our decision making. It's not just mathematical. It's not just logical. And despite what people will say, that's a good thing. Breaking everything down to just cut and dry, logic-based, people will say it's unbiased. That's not true, because the data is human data. And so there's always going to be bias there, because humans have bias, and bias is, again, not always a bad thing. There's so much that goes into our decisions just beyond the regular inputs that an AI is capable of. I think I started. I hope that answers your question.
No, absolutely it does. And the challenges around that unintentional bias, if it's done for the right reasons or it's done for the wrong reasons, and you touched on data as one example, and inevitably there's also the programmer, the architect of the algorithm, whatever biases, intentional or unintentional, are encoded into them. Is it another facet to that construct? But for yourself, what, if any, others, or what are the challenges does that present you with your day-to-day work, when it's kind of cutting through all of those different facets of intentional or unintentional bias?
A lot of times it's just becoming aware of the biases that already exist. With the work that I do, when I go into work with a client, when myself and my team, we go into work with a client, one of the first things we do is we say, we are not bringing any ethics in with us. We're here to figure out how you function, what your framework is, what context you're working in, and how to bring that to the surface so you know what decisions you're making, instead of just saying, okay, we're going to use this data set versus this data set. Or another example I use, you can actually have something called an ethical bias. And that means you are weighing one moral principle more than another. So say you weigh security more than privacy. One of the best examples there are the Corona contact tracing apps. If you were to go in and start creating these apps, or you were creating a tracking app for the coronavirus, if you personally or your company had the ethical bias towards security, you would actually create a central system because it's much easier to protect versus a decentralized system, which would emphasize privacy. Those are two principles that in some way aren't mutually exclusive, but need to find a balance between the two. And that being the best decision there is to actually look at the culture that the company sits in, look at who it's being applied to, what the user base frameworks will be. So it's kind of navigating through all of this. And so it's not necessarily a challenge. It's just one of the elements of what we have to work with. We also take a bit of a unique approach to when we work with our clients. I'll speak very I will use some philosophical heavy terms for just a second here. I promise I'll explain them as I go. So there are kind of three main schools of thought in normative ethics. And normative ethics literally means the one that is deciding what is a good action, what is a bad action. There are three main kind of frameworks, schools of thought, however you want to call them. One is deontological. You'll usually hear it called duty ethics or Kantian ethics. Deontological literally means you have rules and you must follow those rules. Done. Even if the rules end up with a very weird consequence, you must follow those rules. Then you have consequentialists, and that you can also hear it called utilitarian ethics is a common way to call it. And that one focuses on the outcomes, the consequences of your actions. So like if you were doing the self-driving car problem, saving five lives more is better than saving one life because more people benefited under that kind of framework. So you look at the consequences. You don't look at how you got there. You look at the outcomes. Those two are very easy to codify. Those are kind of the default right now of of technology because it's, oh yeah, I can set rules or I can set outcomes. Easy.
And then you can measure against the outcomes.
Yeah. So these two frameworks are quite easy to measure against, quite easy to understand and compare. The problem is they have significant downfalls. Deontological, like I was saying, can end up with very weird consequences where it's like, you will never jaywalk, you know, something simple like that. You will never jaywalk. Jaywalking is bad. And then one day you're walking down the street and I don't know, like a giant rock boulder is rolling down the street towards you or across the street from you. And you see it's going to run over a woman, but you will never jaywalk. So you can't run across and save the woman. That is a weird outcome for a weird rule. Like, okay, of course, that was a very bizarre example that I made there. But the thing with consequentialist theory, you can justify a lot of actions based off of the outcome. So say one of the great examples is there's a paper written about why we should eat babies. And that is a classic example of consequentialism because he makes an argument for, yeah, this benefits all of society. So it doesn't matter that we have to eat the babies, but the outcome is really beneficial. So it's justifying some very strange, you know, something that I think I can be safe to say everyone would agree is not a good thing to do. I'm hoping that's not a crazy assumption that I've just made. But
I think you're pretty safe.
Yeah. And then with that as well, there's not much flexibility because with the rules, they're hard set rules. You're coming into the problem again of, okay, do you set a different rules for each culture? Can you set universal rules? How does that work? How do we encompass all of these different elements? And with consequentialist, again, you're beholden to the outcome. So even like tough love does not exist there, where you're like, you're going to feel a little bit of pain now, but in the end, it's better, or you have to go through this or something like that. No, that doesn't give space to encompass that. So I myself, and also my company's approach, we take the third framework, and that's virtue ethics. This one's not as popular right now, I have to say. It's making a comeback, mm-hmm. but we're a bit niche in this aspect, and can actually thank Shannon Valor in her book, Technology and the Virtues, for a lot of inspiration here. Essentially, virtue ethics concentrates on the virtues and the person. So it's looking at essentially what are good characteristics for a person to have. So you're looking at someone and you say, courage is a good virtue to have. Mm-hmm. Yes. But that sits on a scale. And courage is the middle, where mm-hmm. on one end, if you go too far, then you become reckless and you are trying to fight a tiger with your bare hands. That's too much courage. Then it becomes what you would call a vice. Mm-hmm. Or you can swing in the other direction, and that's when you reach cowardice, when you have no courage whatsoever. So mm-hmm. you're trying to look for the right balance, and it's not only the right balance as per societal norms, it's the right balance for you in the situation that you're in. The reason why people tend to look away from this, especially with technology right now, is that is very hard to put into code. It's kind of like, okay, how in the world can I basically personalize this for everyone that uses this? I can't. What we do instead is we actually look at the people behind the scenes. So we're looking at really going in and helping equip the programmers, the product managers, the founders of, we work a lot with startups, so the founders, on equipping them so that they are, so to speak, virtuous people. Because virtue is a habit, it's something that you form over time. So it leaves space to adapt per cultures, adapt per different sectors and different industries. You practice it over time. It gives you space for, I screwed up, I take responsibility for it, and I move forward. It also keeps pace with innovation. You're not stuck. You don't stunt yourself. Instead, you're looking at, okay, I can easily take these virtues, these principles that my society has agreed on as a whole are good principles to uphold. And then I'm applying them through my own self on a day-to-day basis in the work that I do. So again, we're a bit niche in this. We're kind of taking the almost like, what is it, 180 opposite direction to a lot of the work that's currently done. But we're noticing that that's actually something that encourages people, because it's we're not going in and telling someone you're bad, you didn't follow the rules right. Mm. We're going in and we're saying you're human. Let's teach you how to make more educated decisions. Let's upskill you, so to speak. And that's, we've seen almost this sigh of relief of like, okay, I want to be a good person. And this way I can learn so that my technology is also good at the end of the day. And I don't have this fear of trying to hide things because someone's going to come in and tell me I'm bad.
And see, so many things come off the bat.
Sorry, that was long.
No. It's good. It's just given me so many avenues to kind of break down and explore. But and it's interesting because, and I'm not going to butcher the words that you use. So I'm just going to go with the simple, you know, explanation for those ethical models. So duty ethics and consequential ethics is that they're very rigid, right? So it's kind of a do this, here is the output. And I guess then with your role, by applying that ethical model, you're probably then at a more difficult position when it comes to challenging, you know, people's kind of values and morals. So it's like, well, that's wrong. But then people don't like to hear that's wrong, because in this context, you're also then questioning their own morality and ethics.
Exactly.
Which then kind of strikes them at the core. You know, so that's going to make someone super, super defensive. Mm-hmm. So I kind of see the benefit around the virtue ethics, because also it's a little bit softer, you know. So I think those conversations are then easier to have, and it allows for iteration. So it just feels more agile.
Yeah.
But how do you combat the fact that where you've got two models that are fairly rigid in their framework, where virtue ethics could be argued as also being quite subjective as well, how do you navigate that?
Yes, and that is, I think I've been in one too many conferences and meetings or something where the first thing out of someone's mouth is, ethics is subjective. I know I will have academic philosophers come after me on this, but it's not. Ethics is objective. It really is when you boil it down. Virtue ethics, the part that is objective are the principles, the virtues that you're trying to pursue. In that case, it's actually very objective. So you're looking at, for example, transparency can be seen as a virtue. You're looking for the right balance of that for yourself or your company in your situation. But at the end of the day, you're still working towards the same virtue as everyone else around you. So in that case, it's actually very objective. Yes, the application may seem very subjective because you're taking into account all of these different pieces that are unique to your situation. But to me, that still makes the most logical sense than trying to standardize everything. Instead, you're allowing for space for extraneous circumstances, for all of these exceptions. I mean, you will always find, and looking back at our language conversation as well, learning the French language, you never realize how many exceptions there are to a grammatical rule until you try and learn French, because everything is an exception. You're just like the exception to the exception to the exception. But it's true. Humans, we have exceptions to the exceptions to the exceptions. And that's not a bad thing. That makes us beautiful as human beings. And for me, virtue ethics allows for that space to have those exceptions to the exceptions to the exceptions, while still at the end of the day, working towards the same principle or the same virtue.
And also it ties back to what you mentioned earlier around not having to stunt our growth, because I think it gives you the scale or the spectrum to kind of navigate around, you know. And, you know, one of the other things that I wanted to kind of pull back on in you know, around that context was when you mentioned around the boulder, you know, coming down and, you know, what do you do? I don't jaywalk because I'm not allowed to, so I'll let the boulder hit me. But it's interesting, actually, because that, I think, helps also in me maybe substantiating a little bit more around an earlier question that I asked that I probably confused you around, which was around the different intelligence traits of human beings. And actually that example just kind of triggered something for me, was if you look at the machine, there was a film called I, Robot, where the, I don't know if you've seen the film, but where there were android robots that were there to kind of serve humanity. They did stuff. They were the, you know, they acted as police enforcement. They cleaned people's homes. They basically just did things that humans just didn't want to do. It's like, well, we get an android to do that for us. And one of the dilemmas that came out of the beginning of that film was there was a car crash on a bridge and the car plunged into the river. And in that car was a mother and a child. So the android was sent out to save the people in the car, but there's only one android there at that time. So when the android dived into the river, it made an assessment on the child and the mother based on their life signs. So it can use a technology that was kind of inherently built into the android to assess. And what it assessed was that the child had less chance of surviving the incident than the mother. So the android pulls the mother out of the car and the child doesn't survive. So that was the machine making a logical assessment based on what it ethically thought was the right thing to do, based on life signs, you know, based on blood pressure, things like that. But as a human, that is not the call that we would make.
No. I'm reading a book currently called, it's by a German comedian, so I just got the English translation, but it's called Quality Land. I highly recommend it. It's cracking me up, but it's also this kind of funny reflections on taking to the extreme a lot of our modern day applications. And there's literally this scene where one of the main characters is in a self-driving car and he's talking with the car about the self-driving car problem. And the car is saying like, oh yeah, of course. So I can make much more calculated decisions much faster than a human being. So of course I take into a fact, like in the book, everyone has different levels assigned to them and the levels connote like how much they contribute to the economy. And so the car is literally saying, yeah, you know, like a level 40 person's worth more than like three level 10 people. So of course, like I'd run over the three level 10 people because level 40, you don't run over them. And he's literally having a conversation with the self-driving car and it cracked me up. But yeah, it's true. Like, in that sense, even maybe as a person, we would look at this and go, okay, well, the level 40 person's like, I don't know, a corrupt businessman who causes terrible things to people, and versus the three level 10 people are your family. And so you would make the decision otherwise, differently, because we're taking in more, we're taking in different input, so to speak.
Yeah.
Not saying more, but different.
And it's the time of that input. And I think that's exactly the point. I think, you know, if you look at those different intelligence characteristics that we have, we'll apply them differently in different weightings for different scenarios. But we know to make the call around those weightings. Sometimes we don't make the right call, but it's, you know, and we're not going to expect a machine to do any better. But yeah, I think it's not just, and I think this kind of clarifies the earlier kind of part of the conversation, is it's not just looking at those characteristics in isolation, but it's understanding how do they get applied in what weighting to every situation. And, you know, there's kind of an infinite loop around situations. Yeah. But it's an interesting area of conversation, though. I think adding those elements of dimension to this and then understanding how it translates back to the machine or the code, I think it's an interesting approach.
Yeah.
I guess another area that I was kind of keen to break down was the difference in, was kind of exploring the different types of machine-based intelligence. So we have, let's say, called simulated intelligence, where you've got a machine that plays chess, you know, and that's what it does. It knows, and it's, you know, it's been programmed in all of the possible infinite chess moves, and it kind of works out what is best to do, you know, any point in the game. So you've got something that is simulated that has a degree of rigidity. And then you've got something where there is machine learning, where there is a little bit more awareness of the code to know that it's kind of adapting to a situation to then grow from. And am I correct in assuming that the kind of ethical challenges are different between those two types of kind of modes of artificial intelligence? And does any one of those present more challenges going forward?
Absolutely. The simulated one is a bit easier to understand what decisions it's going to make, because a lot of our ethical challenges are based off of the decisions from the system. So I think we're safe to say as long as the chess playing robot does not like try and punch its opponent, we're pretty safe there at understanding what kind of decisions that may be ethical might come from that system. Versus when we start drifting into the machine learning aspect, one of the big challenges there is what ethics is it learning? There are different ideas going there of what if we just fed that system as much information, as many ethical decisions and challenges that we can think of, or just give it free access to the internet and see what kind of ethics it came back with. You get people saying
that would be an interesting experiment.
Exactly.
You know, I think just letting a machine loose on Facebook, to understand what it's
you're like, I don't know what it would come back with. I think I'd be a bit afraid with what it would come back with from Facebook.
But in fact, actually, that would be an interesting simulation.
Oh, yeah.
A kind of controlled simulation to say we let these different machines loose on different social media platforms and then make some kind of assessment on where their moral compass stands at the end of it. I mean, that would be interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. Literally, like, here, go have fun. Unsupervised learning, go have fun. See what you come back with. There was, I think, I was talking with one friend once. They're like, that would go great, except for what if it just ran across like a bunch of historical documents on Hitler, and all of a sudden it was like, oh, Hitler, yep, this is the ethical code I'm going with. It's like, well, that would be interesting and not exactly what we wanted from that angle. But then the next question then, if you're taking it more of like reinforcement learning, and you're telling the system, okay, make a decision, this was, and then, you know, rewarding or punishing, I'm using colloquial terms, but rewarding or punishing based off of the decision it makes, then you're also questioning back again, who is deciding that that is the right decision that needs to be made versus not. So again, there's another, we're not offloading the ethics onto that system. We are basically bringing our own ethics, or, well, the architect is bringing in his or her own ethics into that situation. So again, who's teaching that? Who's teaching that system? How are they teaching it? In what context? So you also have that problem there. So it's not this neutralizing system as sometimes people like to think. At the end of the day, it is either digesting data that is based off of humans, or it is having a human kind of provide some of these boundaries. Even down to, or even up to, I guess, increasing like black box. One of the fears there is we don't know how it's making those decisions. So it could be perceiving to be making these very strong ethical decisions. And then we put it, then it comes across this new situation and it makes a wildly different decision. And you're sitting there going, that's not at all what we would have, that is not at all aligned with our values. Where in the world did that decision come from? We have no idea because we don't know what the correlation was in the first place. So it does, the different types of these systems have different types of ethical questions and considerations to be making with them.
And from that, I think a really good example comes to mind of a recent event, which was the, and I don't know how close you are to this, was the exam chaos in the UK, where, you know, all the best intentions were that the machine was going to work out the gradings for, you know, the GCSE and the A-level grades. But the output was not the output that I think anybody expected. And without knowing too much information, I'm also just expecting that the programmers of the machine and the people that endorsed it were also not expecting that outcome. So, you know, it's interesting, as you say, that even if you look at, you know, all the best unintentional biases that may be applied, once it's happened and then there's a result, it's then learning from those results and seeing the output. So yeah, I think the, you know, the exam chaos in the UK is probably a good example that falls off the back of that.
Yeah, that was quite the chaos. I like how you're phrasing it as the exam chaos, because it absolutely was. And it's also a great example where these systems, these machines, I want to say about 9 times out of 10 are created with the best intentions possible. I think you got to make room for like 1 or 2 that maybe not so innocent of intentions, but we want to believe, especially even as like a startup founder, you get founder's bias where you're like, there's no way in the world that my company or my machine or whatever we're creating could ever be bad. I have the intention of being good. Yes, that's good. It does not mean that you'll have a good outcome, because there's so many nuances sitting in here that you really have to be able to break down. And that's where an ethicist comes into play quite easily, or in the best possible way. An ethicist can come in and literally play kind of this doomsday, okay, you are very close to this and that's good and I see your intention. Let me sit here and just sit with you in a way where I'm not triggering your defenses, where you don't feel attacked, like your moral code is attacked, and instead sit down with you and break down all of the different pieces and all the different places this can go wrong, take it to the very extreme, and then go, how do we make sure it doesn't get there?
Absolutely. And I think the exam algorithm, the doomed exam algorithm, I think if you look at the, let's just say there was one architect behind it. I know there's going to be multiple, but just keeping it simple, is that person may have made a decision on, let's say, one input, because one of the inputs was to weight the results based on the location of the student. So you apply that, and okay, there seems like there's a little bit of rationale behind that. But when you kind of cut into it, and then you have someone like yourself questioning, you then kind of ask the questions around, well, what are the other biases that get applied here? So as soon as you apply an area, then certain areas might be heavier with ethnic minorities that then get discriminated further, which may not have been the intention. But like you say, that then ends up becoming the output.
Yeah.
And then off the back of that, then there's a whole legal position, because then you can question, rightfully, students can question the fact that there, you know, there's very much, I don't think it's even a gray area. I think the legality is actually very clear that it's highly illegal. But those weren't the intentions, I suspect, of the architect of the algorithm.
Yeah. And another part to that as well, I was talking with a friend, she's a software developer, and she was saying how throughout her entire education and now as well in her professional life, she's always been taught and encouraged to ask how. And that's good. We need people that are kind of that solution-minded, how do I do this? But that will result at times of ignoring the why, which they need to go hand in hand. I'm not saying one's better than the other. I'm saying they need to go hand in hand. Because if you're only asking how, then you're going to start pulling on different data sets. You're going to start looking at alternative data. You're going to start looking at all these different, okay, this data set can kind of, it doesn't exactly answer, but I can kind of infer from it the answer that I needed. And that's when you can, that's when you start introducing risk into your systems, because you're like, okay, I think this might sort of answer this and it does get me to my how, so I'm going to put it in there. But instead of going, okay, this may answer and it kind of gets close to, but why am I using that data set? Is it the appropriate one to use, or are there other consequences that I'm not looking at from it? You need the hand in hand aspect.
And then when you apply that, and again, using that example, it's just very current and I think very relatable to people, is let's say they did use the skills of an AI ethicist to support what they were doing. And, you know, as we've discussed throughout this conversation, there are elements that are objective, there are elements that are subjective. But how do you then navigate using that example around the fact that the ethicist could then potentially then be used as a scapegoat, as in, you know, well, we took advice and this is where it led us, but then the output was still not favorable. That feels like a real issue that you may have on a day-to-day basis.
Oh yeah. One of the big things that we're struggling with right now in establishing AI ethics as this professional title as well, is to make sure that we aren't the scapegoats. So that comes also at a cultural change, at a cultural level, cultural change in a company. I've talked to plenty of people that work in AI ethics that go into a company and they immediately tell, I'm here as a scapegoat. So if anything goes wrong, I'm immediately blamed, because usually you can tell you're going to be a scapegoat if your advice, if no one's listening. There, I was talking to a woman just the other day where she's like, yeah, I was being left out of meetings. She's like, I knew these meetings were happening and I was telling them I needed to be in them and I was being left out of them. And then I had to fight to be in those meetings because I knew immediately if any negative consequences came out of the decisions they were making, I would still be the one that they were putting the blame on, even though I couldn't even get in there. So you have that aspect where you can kind of tell that's an easy scapegoat. The other aspect there is, again, cultural change level of taking accountability. So it's not just the ethicist making the decision. It's the ethicist providing input and advice and context, but it's the whole company. And if something still goes wrong, as it does, we are humans, we make mistakes, instead of going, oh no, we did everything behind it, so it's not our fault, changing that cultural reflex to, hey, we screwed up, we're fixing it now, and we're going to try and make it better. It's something as simple as switching from, we did everything we could and it still turned out bad, and so it's not our fault. No, saying, we did everything we could, it still turned out bad, we're responsible for that, we're going to fix it. Okay, done. I think one of the things that drove me insane, I think a lot of people probably have seen now The Social Dilemma. There is this moment where his title as well was the inventor of the like button on Facebook. You're like, okay, where he was talking about, yeah, we created the like button for the best intention of like making people smile or something like that, or the intention was a good intention. But immediately there were studies done where the year that the like button came out, something like there was like a 40% increase in suicide, and it could be directly connected to that like button. That is the perfect case of, hey, we tried something. It was the best intention. We saw the effect it had. We screwed up. We're going to fix it. We're going to go back and do it, instead of going, no, it's already out there. Not our fault. You deal with it.
And you know, that you know, because you touched on earlier, and as part of that point, is that collective accountability is key. And, you know, how far do you take that collective accountability? Because using those examples, it's organizations. So you kind of, you know, the AI ethicist is not accountable for the full outcome. And I hadn't even actually applied the lens of actually bringing somebody in to already be that pre-planned scapegoat. And but when you look at that collective, there's the organizational collective, but then there's an industry collective around accountability. And those examples around the like button is actually very relevant, because using two examples, you've got the founder of Facebook, which feels like he's in complete denial around the kind of ethical challenges that that platform is having. But in complete contrast, you've got Jack Dorsey at Twitter that has a huge degree of kind of social responsibility and this awakening that he is, you know, looking at it from a completely different lens.
Yeah.
So two platforms that have, you know, potentially the same challenges. The media, you know, the platforms are used to kind of weaponize, you know, societies against societies. But yeah, I think that aspect of kind of an industry collective is also quite relevant to the overall conversation.
Yeah, industry, absolutely. And even turning it back onto general society as well, to understand that these are new technologies and we're going to be making mistakes. And instead of constantly holding it against them, every teeny little thing, instead encouraging the small little steps forward. I've seen it happen quite a lot where a company will come out with an ethical code of conduct or something in terms of AI ethics. And this is a criticism back onto my own community now. We immediately jump to tearing apart of here are all the holes, where it's more helpful, I think, now at the point that we're in, to look at it and go, here are the good things. Here are the steps forward. Yes, we've got holes here. Here's maybe some steps forward to how to fix those holes. But good job. You at least started to make some steps and you're starting to take more accountability for your actions. Encouraging that rather than being like, no, don't do it. Like, you took a step forward, and why did you take that step forward in that direction? Why did you go left? You should have gone right. And it's like, okay, at least you went forward. It's somewhere. We're going to have to play around and get messy for a little forever. It's who we are as humans. We're going to have to be messy and we're going to have to figure it out as we go. But encouraging those steps forward as a society as well will then encourage and push industry forward. Again, if they see, okay, we at least make steps forward, and we can be, in a way, everyone likes to be praised. So we can be praised for those steps forward. We're going to keep moving those steps forwards because, you know, we like being praised and that kind of thing.
But and this is why it's important, I think, you know, when we look at kind of applying rules and governance and ensuring that organizations are conforming, is you're right. I think if you, as you mentioned earlier, you don't want to be too rigid now because you stunt the ability to kind of grow from it. But also you're not really sure what you're applying it to because it's constantly evolving. So I think, you know, what I'm kind of sensing, I think, from what you said just then, is that as a collective, we just muddy our way through this and we just apply what feels like what is right at any given time, and just be open to having an open conversation without barriers.
Exactly.
Olivia, I want to just change direction, change the trajectory a little bit of the conversation, and understand the importance of the role of people like yourself and minorities, and I'm referencing yourself as a woman. And I think that is important to draw out in, you know, in an industry that is heavily influenced by men. And I think there's a couple of reasons to kind of, you know, take us down this part of the conversation. Is if this wasn't a conversation around AI and ethics, it's still very relevant. Because of the, I think, the influence of, you know, of women in roles such as the role that you're playing now and many others. But when you apply the lens of ethics to the question, it gets even more interesting. Because, you know, touching on what you said before about, you know, using the example of women and voting, was the fact that it sounds absurd now, but, you know, if you look at that and you argue it, then to say women can bring some value to allowing them to vote. And the, you know, it sounds just crazy saying it out loud, but when you apply this kind of conversation to to women in tech roles at a role where I think is a role of leadership, because you're influencing the direction of an industry. There's that lens of you being a woman, but also the fact that you bring a lens that most men aren't able to bring to some of these conversations. And I think that's really important.
Yeah, absolutely spot on, which is why when you add in the ethical layer again, this becomes an even more important conversation to have and even more important approach to have. Let's look at it through the lens of biases. I'm going to be able to catch different biases than a man would because I'm looking at it through the lens of a woman. So I can catch the ones that are biased towards women much more easily than a man can, because that is my day-to-day reality. Versus if we're working on another project, I will most likely miss even biases that, let's say, a Black person or a person of color can easily pick up on. That's just how it works. It's because you are already in your lens of your day-to-day reality. So you can easily pick up on these nuances that someone that is not in your shoes can't. Mm. And that's why all of this talk of make sure the right people are around the table are always is good. The cop-out argument that I've heard recently in that direction, which drives me crazy, I think panel, research group, I can't remember, a virtual event, as they all are. I was sitting there listening to person after person go on and saying, well, you know, we employ 50% women, and I'm going through the lens of specifically kind of female entrepreneurship, female women in the workplace at the moment. They're like, yeah, we employ 50% women, or we've met this quota for our women. And yeah, no, we don't have to consider this anymore. We met the quota. And then sat patiently while I listened to all of this. And I said, okay, but how is their input weighted? Is their input weighted 50%, or is it weighted 10% and they're just in the room? It does not matter how many people you have in the room if you're not listening and you're not weighing their opinions, you're weighing their input. So I think that is a cop-out that we're in danger of falling into, especially in the case of women and people of color, minorities in the workplace, is great. You've met your quota. Are you meeting literally like your listening quota or something like that? Are you paying attention to what they're saying?
Well, no, absolutely. Because as you say, if you hit the quota, but there's no influence, then there's no value. Yeah. You know, you're not achieving anything from it. But interestingly, maybe a difficult question is there any place where it's right to increase the influence? And where I'm going with this is, if you look at many technology firms that are, you know, led by men, the politics behind these are led by men, is there an argument that the weighting needs to be greater to counteract some of the direction?
I hear this argument a lot. And I think I can't quite give it a black and white answer. Mm-hmm. I think in some cases, yes, actually increasing the weighting and even counterbalancing it for the time being so that it almost counteracts all of these pieces that have been put in place in the opposite balanced direction is good. I think eventually we don't want to end up in that situation where we're just constantly swinging back and forth and back and forth. Mm-hmm. Instead, it'd be great to be at the point where, yes, even amount of weighting and everything. But I did hear it, and I think this puts it really well. The other week, I heard someone comment of, "Oh, it's an all female panel. Don't you think that's too many women?" And she's actually one of my advisors. She turns around and she goes, "I just watched like 5 panels of all men. No one told me that was too many men on those panels. So no." All female panels, not too many women. She was very riled up. But I was like, yeah, that's spot on in that sense. It's like, okay, well, if it can swing so far in the other direction, then it's fine to swing in back and forth in having an all female panel. Cool. That's great. That means you're getting a lot of input from the opposite direction. So yeah, maybe there is some weight to that argument for current standing of society to maybe swing a bit with being careful, but swinging a bit almost overcorrecting for the time being, so we can kind of even things back out.
And I think that's the right word, actually. It's overcorrecting, mm-hmm. you know, and I think it's having the right forces at play mm-hmm. that can be applied at any given moment. And, you know, when we look at that influence and, you know, a lot of the conversation that a lot of what we've spoken around is the ethical challenges of, you know, what does it mean to humans? Mm-hmm. And, you know, our own biases, the balance that we apply to the conversation, the code, and everything else. Mm-hmm. But where I think it adds another dimension to this conversation, maybe it's not something that would happen in our lifetime now, but is then the ethical rights of the machine. And, you know, this is, for someone that's a sci-fi geek like me, it's, you know, it's like, yes, this is the, you know, really where some of the ethical and moral dilemmas then start to get to a different level of conversation. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't feel like it's something that is relevant to maybe our time right now, but at some point, the intelligence frameworks that have been built into the machines, there is a risk or an opportunity, depending on the lens that's applied to looking at it, that machines could become self-aware. And then when do you start to then apply ethics to not what is right for humans, but then what is right for the machine? And, you know, there's a lot of sci-fi novels, films that kind of dive into this. But what would you say, as an ethicist / philosopher, around what are the attributes, or what is the key attribute that would define the machine as having rights if and when a machine became self-aware?
Oh, you ask a very hard question, a very heavily laden question too. It's one of those answers that just keeps going. I'm trying to think of the place to start with it. In terms of at what point with the proper stipulations would rights come into question, I think there you're looking at moral agency, whether or not a machine can ever be a moral agent. That I have my own questions behind and my own qualms with, because from my perspective and from my research and studies, emotions and the ability to empathize is such a huge component of being a moral agent. Moral agent meaning in this case, a person or an entity that is both worthy of moral consideration and can reason morally as well. And as we've discovered through countless amount of research, a lot of our ethical decisions and moral understanding, emotions play a very heavy weight there. Mm-hmm. And it's because of our ability as humans to say, I have experienced sadness, you've experienced sadness, we have this common understanding. Whereas if a machine can't go, I have experienced sadness, then it can only mirror what a human feels or acts. It can mirror the symptoms, but it doesn't feel actually what's happening. And again, there's a whole school of argument behind all of this. So for me, if we were to ever enter into that conversation of robot rights, we would first need to establish moral agency. And of course, I might be of the school of thought that I don't think that's possible, but that goes down another route. Abeba Berhane puts it very well, though, where she, I think it was her interview on the Radical AI podcast, but she puts it very well where she just asks the question, why are we considering robot rights when humans don't even have equal rights yet? Why are we trying to solve this question?
That's very good.
When we have the other question first? So that's the one I like to refer back to, because I think she put it beautifully of, why don't we just look at the human problems first, and then we can question robot rights.
And we haven't been able to answer that question or apply a framework for centuries.
Yeah.
And then when you apply that to a machine, that I don't know actually what is more complex. You know, it's I think I'm questioning myself now. Is the, you know, our understanding of the machine might be more complex, but our understanding of the human condition is just as complex, or not infinitely complex. It has no real barriers. But I think that's a really interesting way of answering that question. You know, I think, yeah, we don't, you know, we, there's how many humans on the planet, all self-aware, all with consciousness and free will, and we can't apply the standards to them. And interestingly, I think if you apply that lens, and again, I'm going to go into some sci-fi films. That's my...
I like it.
Is you know, that's where, you know, I think I get a lot of my knowledge, shamefully, is that, or shamefully, is using the Terminator films as an example, the machines eliminated humans from the equation because they were the barrier to them kind of growing with a degree of self-awareness. And interestingly, the way you, you know, as you answered the question around, we can't necessarily apply that moral agency to just other humans on the planet, machines could pick that up based on our own behaviors and eliminate our thought process from the equation.
Technology is merely a mirror of humanity back onto itself. And it's perhaps in one way very therapeutic for us to work through technological problems instead of maybe in a way taking it out of the emotionally laden human context and having to work through them in the technological context. And so I can see the benefit there of trying to work through it in that stance. But I think always it's necessary to keep in mind that, okay, we can play around with these ideas in our technology and we can adjust here and there. But it's we're looking back on humanity at the end of the day. We're not just using technology as a band-aid over our problems that we need to face as humanity. We're not overemphasizing robot rights over human rights, but we're not overemphasizing components of technology before we've even solved them for humanity. It's a mirror back onto the aspects of humanity that maybe usually we'd want to hide behind or ignore that we're there, and now we can't because it's very obvious that they exist.
And I'm swinging the conversation around a bit, but you know, just you mentioned earlier about the social dilemma, which I think everybody has seen now, and I think, you know, I think there's a huge awakening off the back of it. And I, you know, I largely support 99%, I think, of what was in the series, but I think the one statement that I struggle with, I'm not quite sure why, and it'd be interesting to explore with you, was at the end of the documentary, I think when Tristan Harris said that, you know, this is potentially a checkmate on humanity. And I'm not sure how I feel about the magnitude of that as a statement. I think there's been many events in humankind where you could draw that conclusion, but I'm just interested to kind of understand the lens that you'd apply to that statement.
I had a similar frustration to you, so this is good.
Good.
And it came in a few different ways. It came in a few different ways because it was so doom and gloom and it's checkmate on humanity and we're too far gone to save anything. The first frustration there was it was portrayed like no one's working in this area. And I know myself and Ethical Intelligence, my company, we are very active in the AI ethics community. The entire grassroots community was felt like we were just screaming into a void of, we're here, we do this work, we're here to help with these problems. It's not hopeless. There are people working in this field, and yet the film just completely ignored all of these efforts going on. So there was that frustration there of, no, it's not checkmate on humanity. Humanity's still fighting. You've just cut out the part that is fighting. So that was kind of that frustration. And then yes, I agree with you. If you phrase it as it's checkmate on humanity, it's kind of like going, well, we screwed up, done. Like, okay.
There's no way back.
Again. Yeah, exactly. Again, we screwed up. Sure. Let's move forward and let's learn. Let's not stunt ourselves.
Yeah, absolutely.
We need to embrace and approach technology with bravery, as with any introduction of a new, even the assembly system. Even with the introduction of the assembly system, there were people questioning, this is the end of humanity. This is the end of the workforce. Mm-hmm. Of course, every introduction of something new usually is coupled with that kind of fear. What we have to be careful with of technology is that we approach it with bravery, that we go, okay, we see there are challenges here and we're going to face them. And yes, it is bringing on new challenges into humanity that we haven't faced before. So it may seem a bit daunting, but the appropriate response is not, we're screwed and we're doomed, the appropriate response is, how do we fix what we've done?
Yeah.
And, you know, make up for our mistakes and move forward and support each other in that.
How do we navigate around it? You know, this is the thing. It's understanding where you are,
mm-hmm.
what are the variables that are being thrown at us, and then understanding how do we pull together to kind of muddy our way through this as we've muddied our way through everything else
yeah.
to still exist
yeah.
in the form that we do better than I think we ever have, regardless of all of the things that are being thrown mm-hmm. left, right, and center. I think, you know, I totally agree. Is this, you know, doom, gloom. And I think one of the reasons I struggle with the statement was mm-hmm. that the documentary has done a lot of positive things, immensely positive. It's woken me up to, you know, mm-hmm. I think some of the dangers and some of the context around that. But I think just putting a label on it like that makes it feel just as bad mm-hmm. as what the technology is doing itself.
That statement, in a way, took agency away from humanity. It said we had no fight back here anymore. And that is a lot of the fear and frustration around technology now is we feel like we don't have any agency there.
You're right. That's, I think, the most succinct way of putting it. It's taking agency away from humanity, which is exactly what the technology is doing now.
Yeah, yeah.
And Olivia, I think this is a really good point, which we wrap up today's conversation. And, you know, I've thoroughly enjoyed this conversation today. It's been quite eye-opening, I think, to have a conversation like this with somebody like yourself. At a time and in a place that is very relevant today,
mm-hmm.
especially around a lot of conversations in this space. And kind of thinking ahead, and we touched on this a little bit earlier around the future event scenario around self-awareness of machines. But one of the things that has always been in my mind is when I apply ethics to artificial intelligence, is I get characters in my head from books, from novels, from TV series. They're always in there, and one of them that's always stood out for me is, I don't know how familiar you are with the old Star Trek Next Generation series, mm-hmm. was Commander Data, who was an android. And I watched that series when I was really young, so it was during my formative years, so it's very much etched
mm-hmm.
in my psyche. But for me, he was a character that always comes to my mind when I have conversations like this. Mm-hmm. And there was an episode where he had a brother, and the difference between him and his brother was that his brother had an emotion chip mm-hmm. installed in him. And what you saw was a complete polarization in characters. You had somebody that was there not just to serve humanity, as in Commander Data, not just there to serve humanity, but serve the universe
mm-hmm.
based on logic and his positronic brain. And then there was a mirror of him with an emotion chip that was going towards the dark side
mm-hmm.
of morality. So for me, Commander Data from the Star Trek series has always been an android or something in this space that kind of comes to my mind. But what I'm interested in understanding from you is, if you look back on any books, films, novels, or anything in that space, is there a character from any of those that resonates with you?
Okay, you're going to laugh when I give this example, because it's not exactly sci-fi, but for some reason, it's the only character that keeps popping up into my head.
Mm-hmm.
So again, I'm warning you, you're going to laugh. But as you're describing this, as you're talking, I just keep picturing Wally in my head. Which sounds so funny, but when I think about it, I'm like, yeah, actually, the whole nature of Wally, he was this funny little robot that had a bit screwy of a chip, but the fact that he was nurturing the plant, it was that nurturing of life, and then as well the focus on relationships, not with another person, but with another robot, his kind. It was mm-hmm. that emphasis of it, this little kind of funky, little chaotic, messy robot going like, no, I'm going to nurture this plant. I'm going to nurture this relationship. And I'm not going to, you know, take the easy way out and just, you know, ignore the plant or something like that. You know, it's that time, that energy, that focus, that love and attention towards life and the beauty of it. for some reason keeps coming back into my mind. So I'm using WALL-E. I know you had a much better example, but I'm going with WALL-E.
No, not at all. I think it's an interesting question, you know, and I think these things are very personal to us, though. Mm. You know, and I think you've explained the reasons why personally WALL-E is, you know, a character that kind of sticks in your mind around this. And I think the interesting thing about this, that question, I think, Olivia, is that it's very personal. It means different things to different people. And I think other people listening to this conversation, it'll trigger them to think about what other characters fall into that space. Mm-hmm. You know, and actually now I might watch WALL-E again. It's been a while since I watched it. But there are so many. There's like Pinocchio. There is just such a, you know, you can go to such an extent, I think, in exploring that. And it's an interesting question. So Olivia, I think this is a good point to close down our conversation. And firstly, I just want to say thank you for your time. And also for engaging, I think, in this conversation in the way that you have. I've thoroughly enjoyed it. There's just so many things that I've learned. And you've added a different perspective to, I think, a lot of my thoughts in this space, mm-hmm. which was one of the outcomes that I wanted from the conversation, which was good. You threw a lot of big words at me that I still can't, you know, I have to get those from you afterwards. But thank you, Olivia. And you know what? Once a friend of the podcast, always a friend of the podcast, and I would welcome you back at any point into this virtual container that is my studio, at any point in the future to have a follow-up conversation, because I'm sure there are things that we've only scratched the surface on today mm-hmm. that I think we can explore at a future time.
Well, first of all, thank you so much, Bobby, for having me on. I have thoroughly enjoyed today's conversation. It was a very nice break from my normal ethics conversations, and being able to start with my Italian heritage and talk language, and then seeing how that came back and resurfaced throughout the conversation, even as we moved into bits and pieces that are a bit closer to my professional heart. I loved that kind of journey to be able to sit and speak with you very openly about that. And I would be, of course, honored to come back on at any time. We scratch so many surfaces. We would have so many different directions to go from. So here's to the start of a hopefully long, long friendship here, Bobby.
Wonderful. Thank you, Olivia. And to my audience, thank you so much for listening. I hope that conversation was just as immersive to listen to as it was for me and Olivia to actually record. As always, I will put detailed show notes and links to everything that we've discussed, or any topic areas or any other touch points that I think will be of relevance following this conversation. I will punch all that stuff into the show notes of today's episode. Now, as I mentioned at the beginning of the episode, don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe to the show, whatever platform you use to listen to your podcasts, and hit me up on my mailing list. You'll get notification of new episode releases and also detailed show notes directly into your inbox. Just click the link in the show notes, add your email address, and you're part of the community. If you've enjoyed today's conversation, have this conversation with other people. Share this episode, because conversation is a gateway in raising awareness, making change happen, and it's one of the most powerful things that we can do. Giving our time and attention to other people, to talk, to observe, to listen, is immensely powerful. So, I want to thank you for listening. This is me on the Bobby Jack Dev podcast. Until next time, thank you for listening.